This is the First Time Podcast.
Part reality series.
Part writer's masterclass. It's a podcast about the first time
you publish a book.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to The First Time.
Lorraine Peck started her career as a portrait painter and magician's assistant in Sydney. After being sawn in half one too many times, she switched to dealing blackjack on the Gold Coast. Bartending and slinging lobsters in the US led to a sales job in the movie industry, before she was propelled into a career in marketing in Australia, the Middle East, Asia, and the US. Consumed by a desire to write crime thrillers, she decided to stop everything and do a writing course to learn how to write the kind of book she loves to read. The Second Son is her first novel and she is at work on a sequel.
Lorraine, normally we get straight into the writing, but you have such a great bio. I feel like I have to delve into some of it. We'll start with magic. I'm very into magic. Well, I don't do magic, but I quite like that magic mentalist kind of show, I suppose. There are very different types of magicians. Mm. What kind of magician did you work for?
I worked for a magician who, you know, we did a lot of kids' parties. I mean, I answered an ad in the paper while I was still in high school, and the ad said, small flexible person wanted for magician's assistant. And as I was a dancer, I figured, yeah, that would be me. So that was my very first job, and I had that job for about 3 years. And we did a lot of kids' parties, and, you know, we went on shows like Pot of Gold and, you know, things like that. This is back in the, you know, late 70s, so, you know, those sorts of shows. It was good fun, and it paid well. Yeah, we had some regular gigs. It was good fun.
That's amazing. And can you give us any insight into, obviously, they're not really sawing you in half?
I signed a contract.
Oh, did you really?
Yeah. And the only thing you'll ever get from me is it's all magic.
Very good. Well, I'm happy with that. I want to help you. If you had to associate one word with being a magician's assistant, what would it be?
Distracting.
Right. That's a good word.
Yes. That was my role.
So portrait painting is the next one on the list.
Yes. That really all came about because my mum is a very good artist and I kind of wanted to follow in her footsteps, and I was reasonably good at people. And I was doing, you know, again, you know, this is while I'm still in school and directly after, I was doing a lot of babysitting and that sort of thing, and kids portraits became my kind of thing while I was babysitting, and they were the people sitting for portraits. I wasn't entering anyone in the Archibald Prize, and I wasn't getting anyone famous to sit for me back then. But I found it unsatisfying.
Unsatisfying?
I realized it wasn't going to be my creative outlet. I'd always thought I was a creative person, but being an artist wasn't it.
I feel like portraits are hard because you're trying to capture a real thing accurately. Like they're sort of a very literal, I mean, there's more to it. You're trying to capture the essence of a person too.
Oh, absolutely. I just don't think I was very good at it. I think to be really good at something, you have to love it. And, you know, I didn't really love it.
So a word for portrait painting?
Unsatisfied.
And then I bet you get asked about this all the time, the movie industry.
Yes. Yeah. Now that was actually hilarious. I was selling, it wasn't as glamorous as it sounds. I was selling B-grade action flicks, you know, with lots of guns on the counter and, you know, girls in prison and stuff like that. But it was hilarious, you know. It was a really good time to be in that industry, and it was a fun time to be in that industry in Australia, and I really enjoyed it. It was, it was hilarious, but and a lot of fun.
Who was your favourite famous person to meet? Were they
I don't think I ever really met anyone famous. Like, I was too far down the totem pole to be meeting anyone famous at that point. Yeah.
I saw Deirdre Brummer in Coles once.
Did you?
He's like a neighbour's.
Yeah. Yeah. Person. Yeah. Well, living in Potts Point, you see Richard Roxburgh all the time, and there's a bunch of people you see around there. Yeah. I sat next to Dame Edna once.
Oh, that's great.
Barry Humphries on a plane. He was hysterical. He said, my companion and I would like a cup of tea, and we'd like some cake too, wouldn't we? We'd like chocolate cake. And he's just looking at me, and I'm just like his willing accomplice. Like, yeah, we would.
Oh, that's lovely. So, Lorraine, alongside all of those things, have you always wanted to be a writer as well?
Yes, I have, but I didn't have any experience becoming a writer. You know, I always wanted to be a writer because I loved to read, and I always felt like I had a book in me and that I wanted to write the kind of books I love to read, and I like reading thrillers and murder mysteries and action thrillers and so on. So I very much wanted to be a writer. It was my secret desire, but it wasn't something I felt that I could pursue. I was a marketing director for a big chunk of my working life, and so the only real writing experience I got was overseeing the copy going into brochures for, you know, large-scale commercial property programs and that sort of thing. So, you know, all this sort of stuff you do as a marketer, advertising, not really the kind of writing we're talking about.
And so was The Second Son the first manuscript you ever attempted?
I have a couple of starts, false starts, shall we say, in the bottom drawer, probably around, you know, 30,000 words. And I've heard quite a lot that that's sort of where, you know, if you don't really know what you're doing, that's kind of where you hit the wall, because you've got an idea, so you know how to start the book, and then you kind of run out of steam. Like, you know, I get to a sex scene, for instance, and I think about my mum and dad reading it, and I just go, ooh!
There's no bigger mood kill, is there?
Just throw it into a drawer, and that would be the end of it. So I had no idea what I was doing. That was the main thing.
So what made The Second Son different?
Well, I was reading The Dry by Jane Harper, and in the acknowledgement section, she mentioned that she had done an online creative writing course with Curtis Brown Creative out of London. And that was like this light bulb moment when I kind of thought to myself, wow, I didn't know you could do a creative writing course online. I could do that. And that kind of set me off, and I did a couple of writing courses, and during those I wrote the first two drafts of The Second Son, and it's a book about a man torn between his duty to his family and his wife and child. Johnny Novak is a career criminal born into a crime family, and his nice middle-class wife just happened to fall in love with a gangster. So that was the idea I had, and I set about learning how to write a book so I could fulfill that lifelong dream.
So, I mean, ideas can come from all places, but they do often say about first novels that there's a degree of autobiography within them. What's your relationship to the, I'm going to say, criminal underworld, which makes me feel like a complete nerd, but... was there any truth to the seed of the kind of the concept?
Well, yes and no. It is a work of fiction. But my first husband was a career criminal. He had retired by the time I met him. His life of crime had happened in America. And by the time I married him, at the age of 30, he had retired, and he stayed straight for the entirety of our 10-year marriage. But then as that marriage broke down, he went back to the States and became involved with the old crew. And so there was a period there when I had some experiences that would come in useful when I was writing from Amy's point of view. You know, like Amy, I guess I am a nice middle-class girl who happened to marry a career criminal. But from, you know, as I said, he was retired. But the inspiration for Johnny Novak came from my husband, my second husband, and, you know, I'm going to say my last husband. In case it sounds like I'm going to have more, or I've had several. And he Stead is Croatian, and so that's where the inspiration came around him, around it being a Croatian crime family. His family, Stead's family, is are not involved in crime in any way. Let me get that straight, okay? But Stead was dyslexic. He or is dyslexic. He left school when he was 14, and he was very much destined for a life of crime. All his friends and colleagues from back in his teenage life are, you know, they're mostly in jail or dead. And he, you know, that was the easy path for him because, you know, he couldn't read. And this is back in the day when, you know, dyslexia wasn't something that was diagnosed and, you know, people weren't given a lot of help. And anyway, in his late teens, he decided that a life of crime probably wasn't going to pay as well as he thought it would, and decided to become a successful businessman instead, which he set about doing, probably fueled by the fact that he was, you know, he's a very hungry person because he'd come from a very working class family. And he had to prove to himself that he could be more than that. And so that he would tell me stories about that time in his life. And that inspired the character of Johnny Novak. And I just wondered if Johnny was born into a crime family, how much harder does that make it for him to escape? Like, how do you escape? And writing a novel, I've discovered, is all about asking your characters questions. And so the question I constantly asked Johnny was, how can you escape? Can you escape? Or, you know, will you stay?
Yeah, that's interesting. The often I guess we think of a male perspective when we think of crime families or in those kinds of novels. But the women, and in particular Amy, play a really big role within The Second Son. How did you think about women, the roles that they play and the power that they kind of wield?
It was interesting because the first draft of the novel was very much based on just getting the plot down and just working out what happened, what each character did. And it was only really during the second draft that I realised, and certainly I had some feedback along the lines of, my female characters were like cardboard. So, and because I was writing about a crime family, essentially a gang, it was, you know, quite patriarchal, and I wanted to balance that up a bit, a lot, in fact. So I wrote one scene from Amy's point of view in first person, and originally the book was written in third person in past tense from Johnny's point of view, in that it's like you're sitting on Johnny's shoulder. You only ever get to see what Johnny gets to see, because I was told that was kind of the easiest way to write a novel. So I stuck with what was easy to do because I didn't know what I was doing. And then I wrote one scene from Amy's point of view in first person in present tense, because I discovered that I quite naturally write in present tense. So every time I'd write a scene, it would be in present tense, and then I'd have to change it to past tense. I thought, I'm going to write it in present tense, and I'm going to write it in first person. I'm going to get under this woman's skin. And I had no real idea at that point that that I could really see through Amy's eyes, because I'd had some experience, some experiences that were perhaps similar to her. And writing from her point of view was so freeing. It was like, oh my God, you know, this is fun. So she just took over half the book at that point, and or throughout later drafts. And she went from being a very kind of naive character, head stuck in the sand, to someone throughout the journey of the novel, she became someone who was just really starting to understand their own power. And similarly, Johnny's mother, who in early drafts was just very much a woman kind of bound to the kitchen, crying and cooking because she just lost her eldest son, becomes someone to reckon with and actually in one scene really takes control of the whole family and what happens next. So I was kind of trying to turn those sort of stereotypes on their head.
And so how did the Curtis Brown course in particular help with the writing process?
Well, the first course I did, and I have to mention it because it was so good, was the first draft writing course with the Writers Studio in Sydney, and that was an online course. And that's kind of helped me with the structure of the novel. The Curtis Brown Creative Writing course really helped with things like characterization and how to write dialogue and starting to delve into the complexities of the plot and how to layer those complexities. But also it really taught me an enormous amount about how to deal positively with feedback.
So it was a lot of workshopping. Was it a lot of workshopping?
Yeah, and some of that was a really positive experience, and some of it was horrendous, you know, like hard. Okay.
Really? Is it? Because it's online. So is it Zoom based, or is it?
Not a lot of it is. Mostly, it all happens on what's called the forum, and you've got 15 students and a tutor. And you every week, three students submit 3,000 words and then everyone critiques them. And that's really valuable because you learn from how others are writing, both how to improve your own writing and sort of seeing other people's mistakes and being able to work out where they're going wrong and provide suggestions. That's all a huge learning curve. But also I learned in that during that course that it was always best to explore suggestions, like not just discount them, not just say, yeah, that's not my worldview. I'm not going to explore that. I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to change. Instead to just, I'm going to try that and just see how it works. And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But the big thing too for me was to learn how to say no. I learned how to kind of hold on to and protect the book I wanted to write and not be diverted down pathways that were going to take me in a whole different direction. And I was very lucky in that I had a complete first draft going into that course. So it was probably easier for me than some students to hang on to my book, the one I wanted to write.
There's such a balance of things, isn't it, to be able to listen to what other people say but also hold steady, because you need both, don't you?
Absolutely. And, you absolutely have to be open because it depends on who you're working with. For me, I have been very lucky to be able to work with an agent and with an editor, and, you know, just to have these professionals interested in making my book better meant that I absolutely had to pay attention to everything they said and try it. But when it came to things like how Johnny would say something, I could stand firm because I just put it through the Stead filter. If Stead wouldn't say it that way, then Johnny's not going to say it that way. So, for instance, the correct grammar would be, we Croats gathered around the table. But Johnny would never say that because Stead would never say that. He'd say, us Croats gathered around the table. So, you know, you kind of have to roll with the punches, as it were, but know where to stand firm.
And so once you had a finished manuscript or a pretty polished one, what was the next step?
I sent it to Alice Lutyens at Curtis Brown Literary Agency in London because having done the Curtis Brown Creative Course, we had a little bit of an in there, and she was Jane Harper's agent, and I was obsessed with Jane Harper throughout this process because she just, you know, opened the door for me just with writing about the courses in her acknowledgement section. So I sent it off to Alice, and I was gobsmacked when she said she loved the book and she wanted to represent me. So that was just, you know, mind-blowing. And the next thing I knew, she'd reached out to Pippa Mason, my wonderful agent here in Australia at Curtis Brown Sydney. And then I'm sitting at the boardroom table with HarperCollins and then with Text Publishing and, you know, being offered a two-book deal and trying to work out, you know, which publisher to go with. And, you know, quite obviously I went with Text, and you're a Text author, Catherine. So you probably
Text are fabulous.
Tell me why you went with
Why did I go with Text? I had met Mandy Brett at a manuscript development program, and I was very taken with Mandy. But I just think Text produce good books.
Yes. And they're an Australian independent publisher, and I really liked that. And there was just charisma, simpatico in that. Yeah.
But there are a lot of good publishers in Australia. I feel like I have to say that as well.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
So, Lorraine, in one of your interviews online, you mentioned having a vision board. Can we talk about the role of vision boards? What are they for you? How do you use them?
Absolutely. Yeah. I think they're incredibly valuable. The first time I did a really, really thorough one, I was 45 and single. So this is after the breakdown of my first marriage. And I wanted love back in my life. And so I put together a bunch of images and phrases that were important to me, really concrete things about what I wanted in my life. You know, there is room in my bed for my soulmate, you know, and he is a rock. And I actually there was this image I found of a man standing on a rock looking out to sea. Oh, he's my rock, you know. And I set it to music. I set it to the Beatles, All You Need Is Love. And so it was like a 60-second commercial to myself. Don't forget, I was a marketing director. So I created this advertising campaign to myself, and I would play it morning and night, morning and at night. And then I played it to myself every day for a month. And within a month, I met Stead. And I've shown that photo of that man standing on a rock looking out to sea to a few people. And everyone says, oh, that's Stead. I mean, and the weird thing was I felt like I recognised him when I saw him. I mean, even his name, Steady as a rock.
Oh,
I'm
my
like,
God.
Stead. So, you know, this shit works is what I'm saying.
You do hear extraordinary vision board stories, and I feel like that is one of them.
Yeah, I use vision statements anytime I'm sort of at a turning point or a milestone or I really, really want something. For instance, during the month where Alice Lutyens had my manuscript and, you know, she was determining whether or not she wanted to represent me or not, I would meditate every day, and as I would put myself into this place where she's already accepted. So I'm just uber grateful. Like I was just incredibly grateful because she'd already said yes. So I'm just sending this big thank you, Alice, into the stratosphere, like every day, just thanking her. And I'm a big believer in sort of paying it forward, gratitude, putting you in the right kind of, vibration. this is going to sound really airy-fairy.
No, I'm into it.
With the universe, right? And so if you're just grateful for it as though it's already happened, the universe will provide. And it did.
I love that. I just listened not long ago to Tim Ferriss' interview that he did with Scott Adams, and he talks about kind of vision boards but also the role of affirmations. Mm-hmm. And he has extraordinary stories about what affirmations have done for him.
Yeah.
But it's the same kind of thing, acting like you already have it.
Yes, being grateful is huge. Mm.
Okay, we'll keep going. The second son ended up coming out in February this year. Is that February this year? Yes.
Yes.
Can you talk us through the publication experience?
Oh, it's really it's really kind of weird and out of body experience, as you know. You're in a kind of nurturing cocoon for months after you've signed the deal, and you're working hand in hand with your editor on draft after draft after draft after edit after edit after edit of your novel. And meanwhile, while you're doing that, you know, you're seeing little things dribble in, like, oh, there's the cover. And I was having monthly meetings with the whole text team about what the plan was and all that sort of stuff. And then, well, for me, I had this huge schedule of things that were going to happen, like all these conferences I was going to go to meet booksellers and all that sort of stuff. And, of course, all of that was derailed by COVID. So text was very nimble in kind of turning around and trying to create assets and things that would get me in front of the booksellers without actually being in front of them. But without going into a huge amount of detail, that part leading up to publication was just incredibly nurturing, and I felt like I was in a cocoon. And then on publication day, you know, boom, you're out in the world. You know, it's like, it's not like you've been booted out of the nest, but it is kind of like, oh God, you have to learn to fly really quickly. And there's, you know, there's all these events and you're being dragged around to bookstores. And I was lucky it was February and that Sydney had sort of opened up, and you know, my text publicist came up and spent that first week and a half with me, and it was all so exciting, and everything was happening at once, and the reviews are coming in, and you know, there's stuff in the paper, and suddenly Channel 10 are on the phone saying they want to have me on their morning program, Studio 10, and it's like, oh my
How
God.
Was that? I went on Channel 10. How was it?
It was really, really nerve-wracking, like, I was...
Have you watched it back?
Yeah, I did. I think I did okay. Like, I didn't talk about the book much.
That's awesome.
Because it's funny, but I've noticed that having that bit about me being a magician's assistant in my bio was like my... it was like this open sesame kind of thing to the media. It's just such an easy way in because it's such a bizarre thing to do, I guess. I don't know. But it was always kind of the start of every interview, and it's just a fun way to start, you know, and it's magic. Huh? Anyway, we did talk about that.
Had you thought about that when putting the bio together?
Not really, because I've always included that in every CV I've ever used throughout my life. A lot of other jobs that I'd done fell by the wayside as unimportant, but that was always just such a funny way to start that it's always worked for me, so I used it again. But I would certainly advise to have a good look at your bio and make sure it's interesting, you know, that there's sticky information in there. My friend Maz Farrelly, who's a TV producer, definitely looked over my bio and definitely helped. And she used the term sticky information. It was a really cool experience. All of those, you know, those events and going to radio stations and being interviewed and all of that was really fun. And also, while I was there, it was fun. In the lead up, it was terrifying. And then afterwards, I'd be going, oh my God, did I do all right? I don't know. I don't think I talked about the book. It was a big learning experience. I think I would talk about the book more next time, but it was a lot of fun. And then you're kind of dealing with an enormous amount of social media, and it's just, there's so much going on. That first 8 to 10 weeks is just extremely busy. And for me, meanwhile, you know, I've got my sequel.
Well, that's right. This book is very much set up for a sequel, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
And how's the sequel going?
It's going really well, actually. I'm on to the sort of halfway through the second draft. So I've got the plot down. So now it's about adding complexity and nuance. And I mean, I'm very lucky in that because it's a sequel, all my main characters are already they're very much alive.
Them.
Yeah, in my head, right? You know, clamoring for attention, and I just really have to come up with, you know, new crimes. And
was it always going to be more than one book?
I came up with that idea lying in bed one night just before I sent it off to Alice Lutyens, my agent in London. I thought, hang on a minute.
It's not done.
What if I did that? Ooh. Okay. And any idea I have that makes me laugh, I go with, you know.
You can feel it, can't you, when it works?
Yeah.
Now, we always like to get advice for other writers on this show. What pearls of wisdom do you have, either about writing or about being a writer?
Okay. I wrote some notes on this, so I'm going to get them because I think this is a really important question. Try a writing course if you haven't already, just to set you off or teach you all the basics, especially if you don't do writing as a career, like you're not a journalist or something, then... And most of us aren't writers as careers, so go and do a writing course. They're great. Write or edit every day to keep your subconscious involved. So your conscious mind can be dealing with the shopping or work-related thing or whatever, but as long as you do a little bit every day, even if it's just 20 minutes, your subconscious will keep working on the problems. And then when you do run into a plot, problem, big hole or a nasty knot, go for a walk and try and think about something else, and your subconscious will come up with a solution. That works for me anyway. So write every day and dream big and meditate, as I mentioned before, meditate as though you're already there, and be grateful as though you're already there, and work really hard. Like put in the hours, put in the work. You will never get anywhere unless you do the work. But then once you've done the work, let go and let the universe provide.
I think you should run a writing course. I think that's very comprehensive advice.
Thank you.
Final question. What is your favourite novel by a debut author?
This is a really hard question. And one of the things that you learn doing a writer's course is that you have to start reading like an author, reading like a writer. And in consequence, the reading experience is forever changed. It's still amazing, still my absolute favourite sport, still the thing I love to do most, but it is forever changed. Did you find that?
I completely agree. Yeah. I feel a bit sad about that too.
Yes. Yeah. It does make some authors that you've always really loved suddenly banal, and makes you that much more adoring and mind blown by other authors because they're just so good at what they do.
Well, you're constantly looking under the hood, aren't you?
Yes. Exactly. So I'm just going to go with a debut from 2020, and it's Anna Downs' The Safe Place. I really loved that book. You know, I love reading action thrillers. I love crime thrillers. I love murder mysteries. And, you know, I also you know, I like a bit of, how do I put this, romance. And I'm not talking about romance novels, but, you know, I don't mind a romantic comedy, you know. And I think Anna's book, though not a comedy, there is that that sort of charismatic thing going on between all her characters that is kind of romantic in that book. And yeah, I loved it. I love it too.
I still, one of those things that I think about in that book is the moment where she calls her mother. It's early on in the piece. This is going to be a spoiler. She calls her mother and her mum's acting really strange. Yeah. And they sort of, I think she's going to ask for money or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
It turns out that it's her mother's birthday and her mum's.
Oh, like, it's such a cruel moment.
Oh, yeah.
Really.
See, all that stuff was just really bang on. It was just, there was some really stuff in there that you, anyone could really, any woman, I think, particularly, could really relate to. Yeah, it's a very relatable book. I loved it. Really clever.
Lorraine Peck, for your first time, remembering you can pass on any question, agent or no agent?
Agents.
Plural. Advance or no advance?
Advance.
Published in Australia, New Zealand only, or overseas territories as well?
ANZ for print, e-books around the world in the English language, audiobooks around the world in the English language, and the print book is going to be published in Germany.
Oh, nice one.
I know, up till Betty.
Have you seen the cover for it yet?
No, it's not coming out till next year.
That'll be exciting. Mm. And number of copies sold?
I don't actually know the answer to that question. I was meaning to ask. The texts are very happy with me, so if they're happy, I'm happy.
That's great. You're very fresh though, like Feb. Yeah. It's only March.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, exactly.
You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at @thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We record this podcast virtually on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders, past and present, and we extend that to our First Nations guests and listeners. Sound production by Phoebe 80, who we can employ because of the wonderful support of our patrons via Patreon. Thank you so much for making this podcast possible.